Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service, presents the Indie Week. This issue is dated February the 12th, 2020. John Feddersen is your reader, and the program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And now, as the woodwinds of the West Wauwatosa, Wisconsin Marching and Chowder Society Brass Band file out of our studio, let's get going with the new issue. The February 12th issue is devoted to, amongst other things, to Raleigh elections, elections coming up. And it's titled, Take It Back, the Indies Recommendations for Restoring Sanity. Prior to getting to that, though, we have a couple of regular columns, actually guest authors. This one is T. Greg Doucette, called Profiles in Cowardice. I told you all that Silent Sam settlement was shady. When my column summarizing the scandal to date ran in mid-December about how the UNC Board of Governors let itself get pimped out by the North Carolina Division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans for $2.5 million in education money plus a participation trophy, there were so many new leaks on a near-daily basis that it seemed inevitable the university would work to end the controversy quickly. The board had five of its members sign onto a comically inept editorial that ran in major newspapers throughout the state, attempting to justify the mafia-style shakedown. In the process, they confessed the university had negotiated with the SCV for months, even though the SCV had no basis to claim ownership of Silent Sam. Disclosed the BOG violated the state's Open Meeting Acts in considering the settlement, admitted that they violated the UNC policy manual in approving it, and revealed for the first time that the BOG had also paid an extra $74,999 to the SCV for, quote, limiting its ability to display flags and banners. Remember that. We'll be coming back to it. Meanwhile, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law attempted to intervene on behalf of UNC students and employees. BOG Chairman Randy Ramsey promptly spazzed out, issuing a press release that was idiotic, even in Ramsey-adjusted terms. Then, when the Lawyers Committee motion was scheduled for a hearing, Ripley Rand of the mega firm Womble Bond Dickinson, supposedly defending the university, said on the record what we already knew was true. The Board of Governors didn't want to win this case. Rand openly acknowledged the collusive nature of the shakedown. The committee's request to intervene was based on that very collusion. Yet, Superior Court Judge Alan Badur denied the motion anyway, before going into a bizarre soliloquy about how emotional the case was. Remember that. We'll be coming back to it, too. As public records requests to the university piled up and a growing number of reporters started asking questions, UNC did a late-night document dump that included the elusive trust agreement benefiting SCV. Among its terms, specifically allowing real property acquisition and the development for the purpose of a facility for use by the beneficiary, and all the attendant expenses for it. In other words, UNC students lost $2,574,999 so neo-Confederates could get a new clubhouse. Then things slowed down for the holidays. Then they got really crazy. The parent company of the Daily Tar Heel, whose reporters have done Pulitzer-level work uncovering this scandal, sued the BOG for the Open Meetings Act violations. A complaint was filed with the Board of Elections requesting an investigation into the SCV's illegal political action committee. Dozens of UNC alumni asked Judge Badur to invalidate the settlement, including an affidavit from a former UNC historian who definitively showed it was the university, not the SCV, that always owned the statue. And the truly grimy underbelly of this sham started to come to light. Remember Judge Badur talking about how emotional the lawsuit was? Turns out the emotion was because Badur was caught having extensive ex parte discussions with his friend Ripley Rand and numerous pre-lawsuit meetings with both lawyers at the law firm where Rand works with Badur's brother, all detailed in Badur's text messages obtained through a public interest records inquest. And remember that $75,999 payment to the SCV? paid with your tax money? The purpose stated in that BOG editorial was an outright lie. The board gave the money to the SCV because the SCV was broke and needed to pay the United Daughters of the Confederacy to buy the rights to the statue. The BOG paid to sue itself, and it was all confirmed by the SCV's own lawyer in an interview with the DTH. All of those developments happened because dozens of reporters dug into this scandal to uncover the truth. Contrast that with our political leaders, who could actually fix this mess, the Republican BOG members who could intervene to address the procedural problems, silence, the Democratic Attorney General who could intervene to address the crimes committed in approving this settlement, silence, the Democratic State Auditor who could investigate the corrupt purpose of that $74,999 payment, silence, the Republican leaders in the General Assembly who could direct their minions on the BOG to honor state law rather than hide behind a crooked settlement of a sham lawsuit, silence. The pervasive, bipartisan cowardice of our political leadership has been unbecoming for a state whose motto is to be rather than to seem. And as we approach what will soon be the fourth month of revelations about silent sham, no one seems likely to grow a spine anytime soon. We deserve better. And a Valentine's Day-related article, let's talk about sexual health, baby. Whether you're single or partnered, or somewhere in between this Valentine's Day, sexually transmitted diseases are something you should keep in mind. Nationally, there's been a 19% increase in chlamydia diagnoses since 2014. Gonorrhea cases have increased by 63%. In North Carolina, these diagnoses have increased at a slower pace, 14 and 58% respectively, but our rates of gonorrhea and chlamydia diagnoses exceed the national average. Though STDs don't always have symptoms, they can still affect you, your partners, and your future kids. So get tested. Practice safe sex, the whole after-school special. And yes, it can be embarrassing and scary to test positive, and it can also be embarrassing and scary to discuss that result with your partners. But it's important to have an honest conversation with your partner so that they can get tested too, and both can get on with the good stuff. In the meanwhile, let's see, they show some numbers. But here's where to get tested. In Durham, Durham County Department of Public Health. Free, confidential STI testing for HIV, gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, and hepatitis C. Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the Department of Public Health on Main Street in Durham. Orange County Health Department has two locations. This is free and confidential. And you can call 919-245-2400 in Orange County to schedule a same-day or next-day appointment. And those are in Hillsboro, 300 West Tryon Street, and 2501 Homestead Road in Chapel Hill. How about Wake County? Confidential testing for those diseases. Payment is on a sliding scale based on income. Proof of income is required. And those are available Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, 8:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m., Tuesday, 9:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m., and the night clinic on Wednesday, 4:30 p.m. I guess this you need to sign in, obviously. And that's at the Human Services Building on Sunnybrook Road in Raleigh, out in New Bern Avenue, just inside the Beltway. Going ahead now to the good, the bad, and the awful. Cal Cunningham gets good. Cal Cunningham couldn't buy a story that good. Last week, CNN reported a political action committee that had formed in January and promptly plopped down $1.9 million on behalf of his main opponent in the Democratic U.S. Senate primary, Erica Smith, was actually a GOP-aligned outfit up to no good. The PAC's ads paint Smith as the racist true progressive on issues like the Green New Deal and Medicare for All, and while it's true that she's further to the left than Cunningham, the obvious meddling allows him to proclaim, not without justification, that Tom Tillis was terrified of facing him in the fall. Smith is a long shot. She's polling at 10% to Cunningham's 29% and had less than $100,000 in cash to Cunningham's more than $1.7 million. Perhaps the GOP was just trying to cause havoc or force Cunningham to the left ahead of the general election, but the PAC's ad buy sure made him look like a strong challenger. Bad. Durham police investigators. 2 years after developer Bill Bishop was found dead in his Durham home, strangled by a dog leash, the dog still attached, the Durham County District Attorney's Office dropped charges against his son, Alexander, now 18. Alexander had previously posited that the dog might have accidentally killed his father, which seems unlikely. More possible is the defense claim that Bill Bishop had coronary blockage that probably contributed to his demise. Now we're faced with one of two possibilities. Alexander Bishop had his life turned upside down for 2 years over a mistake, or he might get away with murder. If either of those happens, blame probably lies, at least in part, with investigator Tony Welsman. Last year, Superior Court Judge Orlando Hudson tossed a bunch of evidence against Alexander Bishop, ruling that Welsman had lied, exaggerated, and, quote, invented facts in his application for search warrants. And the awful, the Raleigh City Council. We'll refrain from commenting on the wisdom of the Raleigh City Council's decision last week to eliminate its 19 citizen advisory councils with a promise of replacing them with something better. But the way they went about it couldn't have been worse or more insulting to the people who elected them. The council sprung this decision on the city with no notice, no opportunity for public input. Councilmember Sage Martin drafted the motions in secret, whipped votes in secret, and kept Councilmember David Cox, the one most likely to raise a stink, completely in the dark. The explanation, according to Martin, was that two previous councils had tried to reform the system and it had failed amid a backlash. This time they wanted to get it done without a fight. And though they won't say this out loud, without having to deal with a bunch of angry people they consider cranks. So, instead, they decided to ask forgiveness, not permission. Forgetting who pays their salaries and that dealing with angry cranks is part of the job description. No matter how good the policy, ramming it through behind closed doors means it will always carry a stink that won't wash off. All right, to the major news columns, and this is a national by Jonathan Weiler. After Iowa, the challengers, opportunities, and the paradox awaiting Democrats in November. I spent the night of the Iowa caucus in a high school cafeteria in Des Moines, observing an exercise in, if not democracy, then perhaps civic engagement. The DSM 43 caucus appeared to go smoothly, and Elizabeth Warren narrowly prevailed. But, as we soon learned, everything else in the state went haywire. It would take the rest of the week for the caucus results to be counted, and even then, an imprecise and error-ridden picture remains. But despite the mind-boggling screw-up by the Iowa Democratic Party, the impression on the ground the week before the caucuses was borne out. Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders had the most vigorous organizations, and they could each claim a victory of sorts. Buttigieg would leave with a hair more delegates and a hint of momentum. Sanders had more votes. The anger at the IDP's failure may accomplish what all the substantive arguments about Iowa going first haven't, killing the Iowa caucus, its prominent role in the nominating process, or both. On Tuesday night, after this indeed goes to print, New Hampshire will vote, the first actual primary in the nation. Even if, as expected, Bernie Sanders wins, the nomination fights won't be settled. Joe Biden began the campaign the odds-on favorite, but he never established a dominant position, and his weaknesses have been exposed. He doesn't particularly energize people. His organization and fundraising have lagged, problems evident in his dismal showing in Iowa. Many Democrats have real concerns about how he'd perform in the long, grueling general election campaign. At the same time, but for different reasons, Buttigieg and Sanders are risky propositions. Warren has clear strengths, but also vulnerabilities. Amy Klobuchar, though making a late push in New Hampshire, is a long shot. Mike Bloomberg, armed to the teeth with unprecedented resources to spend, is about to move in earnest. All of the candidates share the view that Donald Trump is a genuine threat to democracy who must be defeated in November. Who is best positioned to do so, and how, is the fulcrum of the nomination fight. The candidates sit on a continuum between transformation and restoration. The two poles are Sanders and Biden. Sanders, of course, promises a, quote, revolution, a fundamental overhaul of the rules of American capitalism and a major expansion of the safety net. His critique of the status quo is longstanding. America is captive to a small economic elite, profiting off everyone else. The system is rigged. Sanders, both by executive action and by fomenting a revolution from below, will unrig it. Then there's Biden, who believes America is a, quote, beacon of hope and democracy to the world, as he told a crowd in Des Moines last Sunday. America is not fundamentally broken. America and its people are basically good, its foundation and principles enduring and just. Yes, we have some things we can fix, like improving access to health care and addressing climate change, but our real problem is Trump, who has degraded our institution, alienated our allies, and besmirching our standing in the world. We don't need fundamental change. We merely need to excise a cancer from an otherwise strong body. The others fall somewhere in between. Like Sanders, Warren argues that American capitalism needs an overhaul. The rich and powerful dictate terms to everyone else, resulting in a deeply unfair distribution of wealth and opportunity. But Warren has also, over the years, lauded the energy and entrepreneurship of Americans and the benefits of healthy competition as long as the competitors are governed by fair rules. And smart institutions like Warren's brainchild, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Warren is a vigorous reformer, not a revolutionary. Closer to the restoration pole is Buttigieg, whose language of healing evokes, or nostalgizes, a more unified time. But Mayor Pete has also adopted many of the planks of the increasingly liberal grassroots of the party. He supports a $15 federal minimum wage, just like Bernie. He favors high-quality universal health coverage, even if he doesn't endorse M4A, though he once did. He wants a cash allowance to help families pay for long-term care, and he advocates for a carbon-neutral economy. Klobuchar and Bloomberg, who was donating to Republicans as recently as 2018, are certainly closer to the restoration side, but they have also both endorsed liberal positions that are a break from the status quo. Klobuchar also calls for $15 minimum wage, as does Bloomberg. Federally mandated paid family leave, abolition of the Electoral College, and 2 years of free college. Bloomberg wants to cut greenhouse emissions in half within the decade. While there is convergence around notably progressive positions, the nomination fight is playing out against the backdrop of a basic political reality that the most reliable models for predicting presidential election outcomes usually include variables about the short-term health of the macroeconomy. Here, we're not arguing about whether millions of Americans are still in poverty or whether inequality remains at historic highs and major changes are needed to address these ills. The fact is, the indicators of economic well-being most predictive of election outcomes currently bode well for Trump. One consequence for the Democratic field is that the candidates pushing further-reaching programs, especially Sanders and Warren, might gain less traction with the general electorate than they would under different circumstances. That doesn't mean their long-term solutions are wrong. I'm partial to them. But they may be, if nothing else, victims of bad timing. On the other hand, the political scientist Rachel Bitecover, who in 2018 more accurately predicted midterm elections than anyone else did, believes that 2020 will be a Democratic year. The basis of her argument is that there will be maximum anti-Trump turnout, almost regardless of who the Democratic nominee is. If true, this thing obviates one of Sanders' core propositions, that he is uniquely positioned to turn out voters no other candidate could. In hindsight, Sanders might have had a better case in 2016 than he does this year. Regardless, one of the challenging and disorienting features of the 2020 race is that we face both profound long-term problems, including the climate crisis and the urgency of beating Trump. Many on the left will argue that in every election, more moderate Democrats insist that we must beat fill-in-the-blank. and therefore pie-in-the-sky schemes will just have to wait. Meanwhile, we just keep kicking the can down the road. They're not wrong. But the paradox of this moment is that the short-term conditions necessary to get the attention of the electorate in order to sell it on long-term change may not be in place. And the far-reaching consequence of ignoring the menace in the White House may motivate more people to vote Democratic than might bolder plans for deep-seated transformation. Now, Jeffrey Billman, the executive editor, the Indies 2020 primary endorsements. And I will excerpt, I'm sure, parts of this because it's 6 pages long. I'll let you in on a secret, he writes. I hate endorsements. I recognize they're a public service and people rely on them, but every time they roll around, I get a knot in my stomach. It's not the marquee races that keep me up at night. Most people have decided who they're backing for president, and it'll make little difference to them whether we choose Bernie or Bloomberg. That's not to say we don't take that decision seriously. We did, just like every other race. We studied the candidates, we argued about them, and ultimately we reached a decision that not everyone liked. The ones I stress over are the lesser-known campaigns, the races in which many folks don't even know the names of the people running. These are the ones where our endorsements matters, and where we often find ourselves facing a dilemma: qualified, progressive candidates running on similar platforms for the same seat. We try to get them right, but every time we send our endorsements to the printer, a nagging voice in the back of my head wonders which one I screwed up. What if we recommend ousting a perfectly fine incumbent in favor of a challenger who says all the right things but turns out to be all talk? What if we play it safe and default to an incumbent but missing out on an exciting new voice? What if we listen to the wrong people? What if there's some piece of information we've overlooked? What if something... I'll move ahead now to his list of endorsements. For President, Democrat Elizabeth Warren. The Democratic field has a lot of good candidates, but none who blow us away. Any of them would be a significant improvement over Agent Orange, so count us firmly in the we're with whoever camp. And he goes on, for various reasons, to leave Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. We're happy with either. President, Republican Bill Weld. Donald Trump is a racist, mendacious, narcissistic child in a septuagenarian's body. Bill Weld is a grown-up, libertarian-leaning Republican with bipartisan governing experience. Weld has no chance of winning. What a world. U.S. Senator, Democrat, these are Cal Cunningham or Erica Smith. We're punting for now. In 2 weeks, the Indy will have a lengthy issue feature on this race. Because we're still reporting it, we don't want to pick a side just yet. U.S. Senator, Republican, none of these. That's Tom Tillis and, let's see, Paul. Unfortunately, his three primary opponents aren't any better. Paul Wright is insane. Larry Holmquist is a Tea Party nut who ran against Richard Burr in 2016. And Sharon Hudson is endorsed by Lincoln was a tyrant guy, Larry Pittman. No, thanks. The U.S. House, District 2, Deborah Ross. This bluish seat was created during court-ordered redistricting. The two main candidates are Deborah Ross and Monica Johnston-Hostetler, a Wake County school board member. While we like both, we think Ross likely to be more effective. District 4, David Price. We appreciate what Daniel Lockwood is doing, a socialist. He wants to shift the Overton window away from policies that he believes have failed, but that's not enough for us. David Price is a local institution. And with Democrats in control of the House, he's an institution with seniority. He's smart. He knows his district, and he's been a progressive leader since before many of us can remember. Attorney General, Republican, Christine Mumma. The only plausible Republican to replace Josh Stein, Mumma is the executive director of the North Carolina Commission on Actual Innocence, and she's represented 9 people who've been exonerated for crimes they didn't commit. Her two opponents are unremarkable. This one is easy. Governor, Democrat Roy Cooper. Roy Cooper ticked us off when he signed HB 142, a weak-kneed replacement for HB 2. Other than that, he's been fine, especially since getting a functioning veto pen. And Governor, Republican Dan Forrest is a walking punchline, an anti-abortion and anti-LGBTQ zealot who frequently says things that are, well, not particularly well-informed. We considered supporting Holly Grange's opponent, but she boasts about battling with Roy Cooper over infanticide, which is not even remotely accurate, so we're going to pass. Lieutenant Governor, Democrat Chaz Beasley, there are a bunch of Democrats running for the seat, and a bunch of them are strong candidates. There's Alan Thomas, Hoke County Commissioner, State Senator Terry Van Dyne, the favorite and leading fundraiser, but we're siding with an underdog. State Representative Chaz Beasley from Mecklenburg area. We believe he could be a rising star in state politics, smart and proactive. Republican for lieutenant governor, none of them. Like the Dems, the Republicans have a lot of people running for lieutenant governor. Unlike the Dems, the GOP race is pretty much of a clown car. The two biggest names are former Congresswoman Renee Elmers, who brags about being the first woman to endorse Trump, and one-term superintendent of public instruction, Mark Johnson, whose tenure of late has seemed like the one giant scandal, punctuated by the occasional notice-me chest beating. For state auditor, Democrat Beth Wood. We think highly of Luis Toledo, who is running to oust incumbent Democrat Beth Wood, but he doesn't make a strong case for replacing her. State auditor Republican. Republican Tim Hoegmeyer. He spent 12 years in the auditor's office overseeing fraud cases, which in this race gives him a big leg up against Anthony Street, who has no business being a state auditor. Secretary of State, Republican Chad Brown. E.C. Sykes is a religious nut who volunteered for Ted Cruz. Michael LaPaglia wants to drain the swamp of the Secretary of Sanctuary, whatever that means. Chad Brown, a former mayor commissioner of Gaston County, is a pretty conservative guy who admires Pat McCrory's economic development efforts, but he's the most passable, Chad Brown. Commissioner of Agriculture, Democrat, Jenny Wadsworth. Of the three Dems, two jumped out at us. The first, Donovan Watson, is from Durham, a black farmer who runs his family's produce market. The other, Jenny Wadsworth, who has served on the Wake County Soil and Water Conservation District for a decade since she was 21. She's been involved in state democratic policies for just as long, and she's very enthusiastic about all things agriculture. We'd love to see that kind of energy in the department. Commissioner of Insurance, Republican Mike Causey. Say what you want about Mike Causey, but don't say he's corrupt. When developer Greg Lindbergh tried to bribe him to fire an unfriendly senior regulator, Causey reported him to the feds and then wore a wire, leading to Lindbergh's arrest and that of two associates and the arrest of the NCGOP's chairman. State Treasurer, Democrat Matt Leatherman. In a quality field, Leatherman stands out for his experience, working as the policy director for former Treasurer Janet Cowell. Treasurer Ronnie Chatterjee and Dimple Ajmera would make good treasurers as well, but in our estimation, there's no substitute for the wealth of institutional knowledge Leatherman brings. Commissioner of Labor for the Republican, none of these. It'll take some effort to be a worse labor commissioner than our departing elevator queen, Sherry Berry. But by God, these three, Chuck Stanley, Josh Dobson, and Pearl Floyd, are going to try. Superintendent of Public Instruction for the Democrats, Jennifer Mangrum. There are five Dems running to replace Mark Johnson, and we homed in on three. Wake County School Board member Keith Sutton, Chapel Hill Carrboro City School Board member James Barrett, and Jennifer Mangrum, an associate professor at UNC Greensboro, who ran against Senate leader Phil Berger 2 years ago. Sutton's platform, which is focused on equity and the connections between poverty and school performance, would be a welcome corrective to state policy. Barrett wants to eliminate the state's testing regime and immediately establish paid parental leave for state school employees, which we also like, but we're siding with Mangrum, who has been working in education and social justice for more than three decades, and who we believe will be a forceful advocate for the state's schools. And on the Republican side, Catherine Truitt. Dwight Van Horn is a state rep with no education experience. Catherine Truitt served as Governor McCrory's senior education advisor and chancellor of Western Governors University. We disagree with her on charter schools, but at least she has the experience to do the job. Now over to Durham County, Durham Board of Commissioners. And there are these endorsements. Democrat Nita Allam, Nimishina Barnes, Heidi Carter, Brenda Howerton, and Wendy Jacobs. There are 15 people on the ballot, and voters will choose five. We are recommending three incumbents and two newcomers. Nita Alam, Nima Sheena Barnes, Heidi Carter, Brenda Howerton, and Wendy Jacobs. For the State Senate, District 20, Democrat Natalie Murdoch. From the moment Cooper appointed Floyd McKissick Jr. to the State Utilities Commission, the battle over his Senate seat promised to be one of the state's highest-profile races. There's no Republican running, and temporary appointment Mickey Michaud will step down right after the primary. Whoever wins on March 3rd will step right into the job. Gray Ellis, Pierce Freelon, and Natalie Murdoch are the candidates. And Natalie Murdoch gets the nod. She's a supervisor on the county's Swale and Water Conservation District. They're all running on similar platforms. Better funding for schools, teacher raises, access to health care, voter protections. Murdoch has worked her way up through the ranks, and she knows how government functions. She's gotten her hands dirty on the S&W board, quite literally. Durham School Board at Large, Alexandria Valladares. Incumbent Steve Unruh has worked on behalf of Durham Public Schools for over 30 years. So even though his challenger impressed us, we struggled with this one. We think it's time for a fresh perspective that's aligned with Durham Public Schools' new reality in which Latinx kids make up the majority of some schools' student bodies. Over to Orange County, State House, District 58, Democrat Verla Insko, now in her 12th term, North Carolina's longest-serving Democratic House member. With education, health care, the economy, fair and safe election, and diversity as her top priorities, there's no reason she shouldn't serve as 13th. Orange County Board of Commissioners at Large, Democrat Amy Fowler. District Court Judge 15B, Seat 3, a Democrat Hathaway Pendergrass. Judges' judicial races can be difficult to assess because judges can't really tell you much about how they'd rule. That said, we're backing Chapel Hill attorney Hathaway Pendergrass for this seat, which covers Chatham and Orange Counties. Orange County Schools Board of Education, they've had a rough year, to put it mildly. We're endorsing Jennifer Moore, Carrie Doyle, and Latandra Strong for the school board. Orange County Board of Commissioners, District 1, Mark DeRosen and Jean Hamilton, Democrats. Three people are running for two District 1 seats. The easy choice is Mark DeRosen. That leaves a choice between incumbent Penny Rich and newcomer Jean Hamilton, and they go with Hamilton. And over to Wake County endorsements, State Senate, District 18, Democrat Sarah Crawford. Republican, none of these. And State House, District 35, Republican, none of these. State House, District 36, Republican, none of these. In other words, they're not endorsing any Republican candidate. Same with the Republican State House, District 37. And State Senate, District 18. So, over to State House, District 38, Democrat Abe Jones, a former judge and an established player in the local political scene. Quanta Edwards is a newcomer who didn't elaborate much on her platform. Jones supports gun safety, gender equality, and wants to put policies in place to combat domestic violence. He gets the nod. District 33, Democrat Antoine Marshall. Rosa Gill has served this district for 11 years, and we've supported her. But in our questionnaire this year, she told us that trans people should not be eligible for gender dysphoria treatments under the state's health plan. And while we appreciate her advocacy for schools, we can do better. Antoine Marshall has less experience, but he's also passionate and not quite as behind the times. District Court 10B, Seat 3, Democrat Tiffany Myers. Tiffany Myers seems like a genuine badass who overcame a lot of adversity to get to where she is. Based on her life experience, we think she'd bring a nuanced perspective to the bench. Also, 10F, Seat 3, Democrat Damian McCullers, a progressive thinker who believes in restorative justice, which is something we'd like to see more of in North Carolina. Wake County Board of Commissioners, District 1, Democrat Sig Hutchinson. District 3, they endorse Democrat Maria Cervania. And the Register of Deeds, Democrat William L. Madden. The last person elected to this position is currently serving 5 years for embezzlement. William Madden seems like he could get things back on track. And now the There's a page with all of those just reprised in a single line form. So there's then several in their own words from various candidates, which I'll come back to if I'm allowed some time left on this broadcast. But now we are headed over to food and drink, subtitled Eat This. And this is by Nick Williams, food at IndieWeek.com. The Kebabish Cafe on West Chatham Street in Cary. The stew, having cooled for a few hours, has gelatinized into a brick-red cylinder. It holds the shape of the plastic to-go container as it plops into the saucepan. Flecks of herb and whole spice hang suspended in the mold like mosquitoes in amber. As flame licks the bottom of the pan, the gelled mass quickly liquefies, revealing lemon peel and chunks of bone and cartilage. Aromas fill the kitchen. Cardamom, ginger, garam masala, the promise of chili heat, and the gamey, unmistakable tang of mutton. This is paya, a stew of Pakistani origin made by simmering the hooves and trotters of sheep or lamb overnight with a heady blend of spices and chilies. I regarded a hoof in the thick, bubbling broth. It's been a while since I ate anything weird, I thought. In this case, weird is a prejudicial adjective applied by my Western myopia to any food item that contains the less photogenic parts of various beasts. But, of course, there's nothing weird about paya to the millions of people across Pakistan and northern India who opt for a steaming bowl of the stuff as a hearty and almost ridiculously restorative breakfast. In Pakistan, they eat it on cold mornings with naan, says Samreen Nawaz. The protein is very healthy. Nawaz, along with her husband, Syed Yusuf, owns Kerry's Kebabish Cafe, where she's Sam to customers and where I picked up my order of paya. Nawaz and Yusuf, both from Pakistan, opened Kebabish Cafe in 2015, and the restaurant has lashed together a following that comes for its vast menu of specialties from the Indian subcontinent and the Middle East. I had a gigantic lunch at Kebabish Cafe, chicken cooked with apricots, Lahore-style okra, and, best of all, a chilled serving of chaat papdi, tossed with a yogurt dressing that managed to be sweet, spicy, and addictively tart. I meant to try a few bites of this chickpea-based street food staple and take the leftovers home. I mowed through the whole plate. But the frigid winter weather and a stubborn head cold had me in the mood for more rib-sticking fare. I'm mostly uneducated on Pakistani cooking, but paya seemed as good as a primer as any. I secured an order to take away, along with a king's ransom in buttery naan. Paya should not be diminished to a word like weird. It's a serious showcase of the most bristling and fibrous parts of the animal. The spicy broth is shot through with collagen and springy food parts, making for a textural slip and slide. An unfamiliar yet wholly pleasant adventure. Lemon brightens the muttony slickness, and shards of whole spice radiate warmth and richness throughout the dish. And the stew, like everything else at Kebabish Cafe, is undeniably a product of home cooking traditions, far removed from your average heat lamp chafing dish of chicken tikka masala. Yusuf learned to originally cook from his mother, Nawaz explained. Authentic Pakistani dishes, such as nihari, haleem, kuna, and paya. Although he can cook a wide variety of dishes, all made fresh from scratch. Paya enticed me with its boldness, and its melange of simmered marrow and heat seemed to temporarily cure my lingering illness. But it was another Pakistani stew that proved my favorite from Kebabish, haleem. Haleem is popular in Hyderabad, particularly during Ramadan, where citizens breaking their day-long fast appreciate its high-octane calorie load. More a porridge than a stew, Kebabish Cafe's haleem is made from slow-cooked chicken that's whipped together with crushed lentils, pounded wheat, and spices. The end result is enchanting, humming with coriander and garlic, a source of instant comfort and warmth at once familiar and exotic. My wife and I sat at our kitchen island, bolstered against the freezing night, happily plunging naan into our bowls. She proclaimed Halim's deliciousness with an enthusiastic burst of profanity, and I emphatically agreed. We're not the only ones taken with this nigh-perfect cold-weather dish. I love Halim, Nawaz says. It's my favorite. And again, this is 201 West Chatham Street, Cary. Phone 919-377-8794. KababishCafe.com. Over to the music review, or one of the two music articles by David Ford Smith, appearing on February the 15th, coming right up Saturday night, Kings at Raleigh, Lower Dens. In a recent piece for the Creative Independent, the musician Rene Klazik explained how to build a better music industry for the 2020s. Below reams of sage advice about the ethics of streaming platforms and community building, Klazik offers one particularly tough yet pragmatic idea. Be realistic about the nature of this industry and consider your well-being and goals through that lens. I agree with everything in that piece, says Jana Hunter, who leads the Baltimore art pop band Lower Dens, which plays at King's with Ami Dang on Saturday. On the phone, we skip the PR pleasantries and get right to the fragmented state of the industry and how difficult it can be, even for critically acclaimed indie artists to keep going after a decade in the trenches. The last 10 years has been a particularly weird time to evolve as a band, Hunter says. At our level, even with our certain amount of cult fame, it's not possible to support ourselves full-time. Our streaming numbers are good, but with touring income and the other things, the numbers have uniformly gone down, and it's not feasible to live off anymore. Lower Dens cut their teeth in a different era. They were part of the freewheeling Baltimore scene, alternatively austere and psychedelic, that spawned indie totems from Beach House and Dan Deacon to Future Islands, who had moved to Baltimore from North Carolina, and Y. Oak, who later moved to North Carolina from Baltimore. Released between 2010 and 2015, Lower Den's first three records featured some of the finest Roxy music-esque synth-pop of the decade, its 1970s vibe standing apart from a preponderance of 80s-flavored goop, though they could have easily floated on as a bloggy stand-for-nothing throwback. Hunter's dedication to the fine details of his music and his strong perspective made him an engrossing figure to follow as the band surfed the various indie booms and busts of the 2010s. Never politically shy, Hunter countered his city's musical success in a thoughtful op-ed for Pitchfork in 2015 about how Baltimore's music scene, despite a liberal, colorful, and subversive reputation, suffered a lack of inclusivity. On a 2019 album, The Competition, the band contracted from a quartet to a duo and took their outspoken nature to a new level. A number of indie radio outlets flat out refused to add or play the album's major single, the tongue-in-cheek synth-pop takedown Young Republicans, citing it as too controversial. So annoying, Hunter says in a dry, amused voice. The country is in chaos, but no, we don't want to offend anyone by naming a song after a college political organization. The song centers on a proud conservative initiate maniacally expounding on his elite brotherhood. He cloaks his sociopathy in a persecution complex, tossing out juvenile, inarguable justifications. Like an exclamation point on this character study, the surreal music video features men in suits, cannibalistically feasting on Hunter's entrails. According to Hunter, the album's name and overarching concept stems from the competition created by capitalism, a, quote, psychosis that accelerates our insecurities and anxieties to the point of total overload, corroding our intimacies, our communities, and our sense of self. like the best of their sonic predecessors, Suzy Sue, OMD, even Kraftwerk, it couches conceptual heft in lovely otherworldly pop that largely feels out of time or trend. Soaring album opener Galapagos is a respite from the void, a moment of connection earned through shared pain. Hunter's vocals are thick and sensuous, selling a utopian conceit with dizzying ease. The record was written during a particularly tumultuous three-year period in which Hunter moved to Los Angeles and began an ongoing gender transition process, something that affected his writing and led to bouts with his mental health. His voice sounds essentially the same on the record, but as he told Billboard's John Norris in an interview last fall, he's still worried about not being accepted on his own terms. Whether Lower Dens will keep going indefinitely is an open question. Hunter suggests that a hiatus might be coming. Whatever the outcome, it would be a shame to see him vanish. His voice, elegant and incisive, is still one of the brightest in modern music. It's a tough competition, this mid-level indie band business. But hopefully Lower Dens can persevere in the unexpected, defiant ways that their music always suggests. All right, and we don't get to poetry very often, but here is an article by Monet Noel Marshall concerning Alexis Pauline Gums and her new finale of her poetry trilogy. Check your phone. Not because you actually need to, but because it's a habit. Then put it down and open Dub Finding Ceremony, the final book in a trilogy by Durham-based poet and scholar Alexis Pauline Gums, who is also a columnist for The Indie. Read the opening quote from Sylvia Winter. Realize that it feels over your head and you don't know who Sylvia Winters is. Feel dumb. Check your phone again to distract yourself from feeling dumb. Then put it down because you want to be a literate, learned person. At first, you're scrolling through the book like you scroll Instagram. Then you stop at Request, which says, "We would like it if you drank water. We would love it if you would turn off your phone. We would sincerely appreciate it if you stopped pretending to be alone." Damn. Get a glass of water. Grab that candle you've been waiting to burn just because it feels right. Check your phone one more time. No one called or texted or DM'd the last two times you checked, which makes you feel, well, alone. So you put it on silence, face down. Turn the page. Read Commitment, which says, "We promise to think of you more often than you think of us." Wonder about that, we. Think of your grandma. Think you should call your grandma. Remember that your grandma is gone. Gone like dead. Start to think about thinking about death, but don't. Drink some water. Read Instructions. When it tells you to breathe, you breathe. You didn't mean to. You just did. At this point, you have a choice. You can go back to a note and decipher it to learn more about both the author and Sylvia Winter. Gums writes that Winter is, quote, "a world historical Caribbean theorist who is about my grandmother's age." Remember that you have a grandma or a grandma-like figure who is alive. Call her. Or say to yourself you don't have time, that you have to do the dishes or the laundry, make the bed, make the call the doctor, attend the meeting, meet the maker, or make the meal. You don't, actually. That's okay, but whatever you choose, promise to return and keep your promise this time. When you continue reading, turn to Opening, because that's where you left off, and books are meant to be read in a linear fashion. You learned that in school. Read the first poem, which begins, "If you gathered them, they would be everyone," and ends, "They will unfound you and surround you, unfind you and unwind you, travel to you, unravel through your own needle, gather the thread, collect your dead." Start to feel feelings. Feel away about feeling feelings. Reach for your phone. Put it down. Drink the water instead. All the while, think about your people. Feel unprepared to gather all of them, the slaves and slave owners, the humans and the animals, the colonized and the colonizers, the heralded and the forgotten. Take a deep breath. drink some water, release the need for the linear, and turn the pages. Stop on a poem about mothers. Say, not today, but it's too late. The poem is short and potent, and somehow in your refusal, you've already read it. Take a deep breath, drink some water, turn the pages. Find a poem that is a blessing. When was the last time you felt blessed? Take a deep breath, drink some water, turn the pages. Read a poem about black women that says, between you and me, we knew it would never work. Just because the singing of the whales had caused bumper stickers and rallies and international bans on their murder and the criminalization of the exploding harpoon, you know, that thing that got under the skin and destroyed them from the inside, didn't mean it would work for us. I mean, how long have we black women been singing? You feel shame, no matter who you are. Breathe, drink, turn. This one is about water, but your cup is empty. You go to refill it, and for some reason this mundane task feels like a miracle. You whisper, thank you, hoping no one actually hears you, but the right ones did. They always do. Sneak a peek at your phone to check the time, you know. Shoot! You really do need to go walk the dog, dog the man the store, store the notes, note the change, and change the diaper. Sit and read one more. Turn to page 13, which says, there are very few things you must do. This is one. This will show you the others. There is a difference between assignment and need. Damn. You check your phone and life is calling, but you promise to return. You keep your promise this time. You return with tea. You return with others. You return with your favorite pen. You return with your newfound respect for winter and gums. You return at the river. You return at the beach. You return with tears. You return with questions. You return with anger. But you return and return and return because, deep down, you know that our separateness is a lie, because you have seen your uncle's eyes in a face that they keep saying looks nothing like yours, and yet, because the whales sing a song that vibrates in you like memory. Because these words remind you of all the who's, what's, when's, where's, and why's we have been. And this record of inevitable transformation means there is hope for us yet. Turn the pages. Drink the water. Breathe. And another music story. Dan Ruccia writes The Shape of Song. Jennifer Curtis and Tyshawn Sorey's new album grew out of a bad gig. The two were playing Sorey's monodrama Prayer Noir, Meditations for Josephine, with the International Contemporary Ensemble at the 2016 Mostly Mozart Festival in New York City. They were trying to cram the 90-minute piece into an hour, and the space and audience were awkward. We walked off feeling really weird, Curtis says. But after the show, Curtis and Sorey were approached by producer Randy Ezrati. Even in the cramped confines of the show, he had been struck by the semi-improvised duos the two played throughout the work and wanted to help them make an album. The eventual result was Invisible Ritual, which was released by Tundra on January 24th. As its title suggests, it draws forth a hidden stratum of shared personal history from the pair's musical friendship. Curtis and Sorey already knew each other well through their collaborations with International Contemporary Ensemble, in which Curtis, a Chapel Hill native, is a longtime violinist. But both of their backgrounds extend far beyond the rarefied world of contemporary classical music. Curtis has played drums in rock bands, written tunes on mandolin, studied deep listening with Paulines Oliveras, and much more. Sorey first made his name as an infinitely versatile jazz drummer with Vijay Iyer, Steve Lehman, John Zorn, and Roscoe Mitchell. Over the past decade, he's proven himself equally adept as a pianist and composer. He was named a MacArthur Fellow and recently followed Anthony Braxton as professor of composition and creative music at Wesleyan University. I'm going to excerpt some of this because our time is going away. The 8 untitled tracks on Invisible Ritual show off the vast sonic array these performers have at their fingertips. In track 4, Curtis toggles between a forgotten Led Zeppelin lick and an arpeggiated riff from some nameless romantic violin concerto, all of which evolves into bursts of fiddling. Sori's drumming is supremely flexible, grabbing shards of Curtis' rhythm and extrapolating everything from clattering free jazz textures and fractured hard rock beats to flashes of funky breakbeats. When Sori switches to piano, an entirely different mood emerges. Track 3 is built around dense, dissonant, Morton Feldman-esque piano chords, each of which seems to contain its own universe. And on track 6, Curtis becomes a torch singer, exploring some inevitable sadness over rich-hued piano accompaniment. When they finished recording that track, the two agreed that they had just played the story from that car ride conversation. Listening to these performances, it's sometimes hard to believe they are fully improvised. They all have a sense of structure, as if Curtis and Sori have unconsciously agreed where they're going to go. For Curtis, that shape comes in part from her time creating improvised healing ceremonies with the Peruvian musicians and Curandero de Sondido, sound healer, Tito La Rosa, in the early 2010s. Everything has to feel good, she recalls, and it has to feel like an emotional journey. You've got to have this invocation. You've got to have exploration and acknowledgement and the conflict and the climax and then the peace, the peacefulness, and the embers are burning out. So the shape of a song became something that I was viscerally experiencing. While none of the pieces on this album quite have that arc, the sense of ritual remains. A reflection of all those things that remain hidden behind an improvisation, the shared conversations, life experiences, histories, patterns of thought, and musical intuitions that can be revealed only through performance. And time's up for today. Indie Week was presented by North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and read by John Federson, intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. After this initial broadcast, the show is available as a podcast, which you can find on our website. And so our woodwind section is back from their march around the block in the rain. And so while they drip over on the welcome carpet, we will sign off for today's reading of Indie Week. John Federson wishing everybody a good day.